As some smart people on the left are saying, we should hope that Biden loses. But if he wins, if we're stuck with him, then we should know what we're in for. This is the kind of person that DSA is telling us to vote for. This is the kind of person Cornel West is telling us to vote for. Not to mention Chomsky and other supposed leftists. This article is from Mint Print News. It's called Time's Editorial Let Slip Joe Biden's Latin America Policy, More Obama-Style Coups. Figures on both the right and the left are presenting Biden as a progressive champion. The reality, though, is that he has always represented the right wing of the Democratic Party, and his Latin America policy is no exception. This was written just a couple of days ago by Alan McLeod. With less than a week to go, polling shows Democratic candidate Joe Biden to hold a 7.1-point average lead on incumbent President Donald Trump. Thus, thoughts of what his foreign policy would look like have come to the fore. Yesterday, the New York Times published a long piece discussing the 77-year-old's plans for Latin America. The Times was hopeful, noting that Biden would seek to repudiate Trump's hardball approach to the region, which has caused a great deal of harm, rallying around shared goals of combating climate change. Yet buried deep in the article is perhaps the most eye-opening sentence. Mr. Biden's advisors say they would seek to revive the anti-corruption campaign that set off political earthquakes across the Americas starting in 2014, but largely stalled in recent years. What the authors are referring to is a continent-wide campaign to unseat progressive leaders that ended in the jailing of Brazilian President Lula da Silva, the impeachment of his successor Dilma Rousseff, and the rise of the far-right authoritarian Jair Bolsonaro. The so-called Operation Car Wash, Lava Jato in Portuguese, was ostensibly an attempt to root out corruption at all levels of society. Yet leaked documents and recordings have shown that from the beginning it was a naked power play attempt by Brazil's rich elite to take control of society from the Progressive Workers' Party administrations through legal means. And Mr. Biden's advisors say they would seek to revive the anti-corruption campaign that set off political earthquakes across the Americas starting in 2014, but largely stalled in recent years. This supposed anti-corruption purge was presided over by Judge Sergio Moro, who presented himself as a neutral actor working in the people's interest. But an investigation by The Intercept showed that Moro was in fact in constant contact with the prosecution, instructing them on how to proceed to impeach Lula. Once Lula was imprisoned and barred from running in the 2018 election, despite being the overwhelming favorite to win, Moro took a job as justice minister in Bolsonaro's cabinet. The case against the two Workers' Party presidents was weak, to say the least, with many of those leading the prosecution themselves under investigation for more serious corruption cases. Earlier this year, The Intercept also revealed how intimately and illegally involved the Obama and Trump administrations were in Lava Jato. The U.S. Department of Justice was operating in secret from the Brazilian government, working closely with the prosecution, training, coaching, and advising them on how best to proceed. The National Security Agency, NSA, under Obama-Biden, also bugged the phones of 29 top Brazilian officials, including President Dilma and many of her staff. This despite Brazil being an official ally of the United States. Yet, since Lula's election in 2002, Brazil has also been a thorn in the side of Washington, acting as a barrier to American regime change operations against leftist governments in the region. Lula, a self-described socialist and anti-imperialist, forged close ties with leaders like Venezuela's Hugo Chavez and Cuba's Castro brothers, while also refusing to support a U.S.-backed right-wing secessionist movement in eastern Bolivia aimed at undermining President Evo Morales. Lula later drew Washington's ire by independently brokering a nuclear deal with Iran that undermined Obama's claims that Tehran would never agree to one, hence the need for sanctions. This is me speaking. So again, we have a plot where we initially think the good guys are the bad guys and the bad guys are the good guys. I kind of enjoy reading stories like that, especially when the ending is happy. But unless we get the word out about this shit, and unless humans become more humane, we're going to be in big trouble. We have to admit that the Obama-Biden administration was fucking evil. And we also have to admit that the deep state has continued unfettered since Obama left office. And so, while the Times report presents Bolsonaro as an adversary of Biden, his rise was directly facilitated by the Obama administration's policies in Latin America. And then there's a link to another Mint Press news article called "Former Brazilian President Lula da Silva, Obama, Hillary ordered me not to negotiate with Iran." In a wide-ranging interview, former President of Brazil Lula da Silva described how the U.S. ordered him not to negotiate with Iran. Biden's advisors have also laid out their plans for Central America, which includes a $750 million package tied to privatization drives and austerity measures that might perpetuate the very economic and political conditions that led migrants to flee in the first place. His team also doubled down on his commitment to regime change in Venezuela, although, like Trump, he appears to be growing weary of U.S.-backed figure Juan Guaido. Here's another Mint Press News article called "Mass Incarceration to Plan Colombia, Biden's Role in the War on Drugs." Former VP Joe Biden has a sordid history of opposing progressive criminal justice legislation and played a central role in the war on drugs. Figures both on the right and the left are presenting Biden as a progressive champion. Conservative commentator Ben Shapiro described the Democrats as the party of Bernie Sanders, claiming that Biden is a facade for leftist radicalism. In equally questionable fashion, Representative Ilhan Omar also claimed that she expected a leftward shift from Biden after the election. Biden, however, is currently considering a number of Republicans for senior positions in his administration, while sidelining Sanders and even Elizabeth Warren, despite their widespread popular support among the party's rank and file. In reality, Biden has always represented the right wing of the Democratic Party, and his policy on Latin America is little different, bearing more similarities than differences with the Trump administration's. Now we turn to the World Socialist website, "Corporate America Puts Its Money on Biden and the Democrats," by Patrick Martin. The final financial reports before the election were filed by candidates for Congress and the White House by October 15th with the Federal Election Commission, FEC, detailing fundraising and spending in the third quarter, July 1st through September 30th. These reports are limited to the funds raised directly by the campaigns themselves and exclude fundraising through supporting PACs, political action committees, usually funded by billionaires. Nonetheless, the FEC data provides some eye-opening insights into the political calculations of the American ruling elite, where there is increasing expectation of a Democratic victory on November 3rd. Two preliminary observations can be made. First, large sections of big business favor a shift from Trump to Biden, partly because of differences on foreign and domestic policy, partly because they regard a second Trump term as more likely to provoke an uncontrollable social and political explosion in America. Always go with Wall Street and the betting markets. So, dear viewers and listeners, if you feel that it's time for an uncontrollable social and political explosion in America, don't vote for Joe Biden. Back to the story. Second, the corporate elite now views Biden and the Democrats as the favorites to win the election, and campaign contributions are a form of political insurance, giving the donors a seat at the table when a future Biden administration is staffed and determines its policy priorities. The Democrats hold a decided edge in fundraising in each of the major sectors of the 2020 political battlefield. In the presidential campaign, Trump's early dominance is a distant memory. Biden has outraised him beginning in May, and his lead has grown with each passing month. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, the Biden campaign has raised $810 million and supporting organizations have raised $373 million for a total of $1.183 billion. The Trump campaign has raised $552 million, supplemented by $256 million from outside groups for a combined total of $808 million. In the Senate, the Democrats have outraised Republicans by a margin of more than 50%. $767 million to $500 million, despite the Republicans holding 23 of the 35 seats being contested on November 3rd. In the 435 House contests, the Democrats hold a slightly narrower lead, $772 million to $653 million. Both figures represent a sharp departure from recent congressional elections, at least until 2018, in which the Republican Party has generally enjoyed a huge financial edge. The presidential fundraising figures represent sharp increases from 2016, when Democrat Hillary Clinton raised a combined total of $770 million, while Trump raised $433 million. By October 1st, the Biden and Trump campaigns had already spent three times the amount expended at a similar point in 2016, a reflection both of the massively increased fundraising and the need to reach early and mail-in voters. The Democratic Party and the corporate media have generally attributed the Biden campaign's financial edge to a surge of small-dollar contributions. There certainly has been such a surge, at least compared to the early stages of the Biden campaign for the Democratic nomination, when small-dollar internet contributions went overwhelmingly to Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. At that point, Biden was sustained by a relative handful of wealthy backers. But according to a recent tabulation by the Center for Responsive Politics, which maintains the Open Secrets database of campaign finance information, Trump and Biden have raised roughly equal amounts in contributions of $200 or less, between $200 million and $250 million apiece, mainly over the internet. The difference between the campaigns is accounted for primarily by big dollar contributions, with Biden raising far more than Trump. As the New York Times admitted in an article posted on its website Wednesday, the elite world of billionaires and multimillionaires has remained a critical cog in the Biden money machine. The Times continued, "From Hollywood to Silicon Valley to Wall Street, Mr. Biden's campaign has aggressively courted the mega donor class. It has raised almost $200 million from donors who gave at least $100,000 to his joint operations with the Democratic Party in the last 6 months, about twice as much as President Trump raised from six-figure donors in that time, according to an analysis of new federal records. Million-dollar donors came from Hollywood, Jeffrey Katzenberg. Oh, wait a minute, is this the same Jeffrey Katzenberg who gave $20 million to Cenk Uygur? Ding, ding, ding. Silicon Valley, Reed Hastings of Netflix and many others, and high finance. Top executives with investment, private equity, and venture capital firms like Blackstone, Bain Capital, Kleiner Perkins, and Warburg Pincus all contributed handsomely," the Times noted. While Biden has lately attempted to sound a populist note, claiming that he represents Scranton, his birthplace, a decaying industrial city in northeastern Pennsylvania, while Trump represents the moneyed elite of Park Avenue, it turns out that Scranton has a different meaning to his campaign finance operation. Any affluent donor who solicits a total of $250,000 in contributions is considered a member of the Scranton Circle of elite donors with special access to top advisors of the candidate. There is also a Philly founder level for those generating $500,000 in contributions and a Delaware Circle for those accounting for $1 million or more. This is sick. Entering the month of October, the Biden campaign had $180.6 million in cash on hand, while the Trump campaign reported only $63.1 million, one-third of the Democrats' total. This disparity was despite the Biden campaign's outspending Trump's by 2-to-1 during the month of September. After raising a record-shattering $365 million in August, the Biden campaign raised an even larger amount, $383 million, the following month. Trump has not lacked for mega donor support, including $75 million from casino billionaire Sheldon Adelson, $21 million from Isaac Perlmutter, chairman of Marvel Entertainment, and $10 million from banking heir Timothy Mellon. But these sums are dwarfed by the $100 million for Biden from billionaire Michael Bloomberg, who briefly sought the Democratic presidential nomination for himself and spent $1.1 billion in that effort, and another $106 million from the Future Forward PAC, based in Silicon Valley, whose funding includes $22 million from the Facebook co-founder Dustin Moskovitz, $6 million from Jeff Lawson of Twilio, $5 million from cryptocurrency trader Sam Bankman-Fried, and $2.5 million from Eric Schmidt, former CEO of Google. Such figures make nonsense of the fascistic rhetoric of Trump, who continually denounces Biden as the tool of socialists, communists, and the radical left. Actually, Biden is a tried and tested tool of Wall Street and corporate America, dating back to his days as a senator from Delaware, a center of tax evasion. The tiny state has more corporations headquartered there for tax purposes, over 1 million, than human beings. His services to the corporate elite continued through his tenure as vice president in the Obama administration, when he oversaw both the bailout of Wall Street and the bankruptcy restructuring of the auto industry, in which wages for new workers were cut in half. Good old Scranton Joe. It was to his supporters in the financial aristocracy at an exclusive fundraiser last year in Manhattan that Biden made his notorious pledge, the most truthful declaration of his entire campaign, that if he were elected president, no one's standard of living would change. Nothing would fundamentally change. The financial constraints on the Trump campaign are unmistakable. In the final week of September and the first week of October, for example, it stopped advertising in 4 battleground states, Iowa, Ohio, Texas, and New Hampshire. One advertising industry tally had Biden topping Trump in campaign spending in 72 out of 83 media markets where both campaigns were still competing. The disparity between Biden and Trump campaigns has been exacerbated by the timing of their expenditures. Trump spent lavishly in the early months of 2020, even before the Democratic nominee had been determined, and has raised less overall. The result is a cash crunch in the final weeks of the campaign. Biden began the month of August with a 3-to-1 advantage in terms of financial resources and has outspent Trump in 3 critical battleground states, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, by that margin, $53 million to $17 million. According to figures reported in advertising trade publications, Biden has a 5-to-1 advantage in the Milwaukee, Wisconsin market and more than a 2-to-1 advantage in Detroit and Philadelphia. In Omaha, Nebraska, where a single electoral vote is at stake in the 2nd congressional district, Biden has spent $2 million on advertising, 6 times the Trump total. So, with the Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden holding an apparently comfortable lead over Trump in the polls, much of the media attention has shifted to the question of which party will be in control of the Senate after November 3rd. The Republicans currently have a 3-seat majority, 53 to 47, so the Democrats must gain a net of 3 seats if Biden wins, as a Vice President Kamala Harris would then have the tie-breaking vote in the Senate. The Democrats must gain 4 seats if Biden loses, but that combination is highly unlikely, since a Biden defeat would signify a broader Democratic debacle. In the Senate, the Democrats have outraised Republicans by a margin of more than 50%, 767 million to 500 million, despite the Republicans holding 23 of the 35 seats being contested November 3rd. In the 16 seats considered competitive, 2 held by Democrats, 14 by Republicans, the Democratic lead is 643 million to 415 million. The average Democrat has a $40 million war chest, while the Republican, usually an incumbent, averages $26 million. More so than Biden, the Senate candidates have benefited from a flood of small-dollar donations over the internet, which expresses, in a distorted way, the popular hatred of the right-wing policies of Trump and the Republicans. But corporate and billionaire cash also plays a significant role. Both small-dollar and large-dollar donations have fueled a record-breaking third quarter of fundraising for the Democrats, with many challengers doubling or tripling the amount raised by the Republican incumbents. Ordinarily, incumbent senators have a huge fundraising advantage over their challengers, and this applies particularly to Republican incumbents, who usually have closer ties to wealthy donors. But in 2020, this is not the case, and the disparities are remarkable. There are at least 8 Democratic challengers who have outraised their Republican opponents. 3 of these Democrats have raked in more than $80 million apiece, an astonishing total for an election in a single state. So what's clear from all of these information points, dear viewers and listeners, is that the Democrats are the party of big money. So when everyone says vote blue no matter who, they're voting for Wall Street, and they're telling you to vote for Wall Street. Democrat Jamie Harrison reported raising $86.9 million in South Carolina, compared to $59.4 million for 3-term Senator Lindsey Graham. The combined total of $146.4 million in a relatively small state, where only 2 million people voted in 2016, means an expenditure of better than $70 a vote. That's pretty crass, isn't it? Telling you how many dollars they spend per vote. Tells you what they think of you. All they've got to do is spend enough money and they have your vote. That's especially true of comfy Democrats who don't feel the pain of the working poor. That was me, if you couldn't tell. Back to the story. In an even smaller state, Kentucky, Democrat Amy McGrath has raised $84.2 million for her uphill contest against Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who has raised $53.4 million. In Arizona, Democratic challenger Mark Kelly has raised $82.8 million and leads in the polls against the incumbent Republican, appointed Senator Martha McSally, who has raised $50.9 million. Several other Democratic challengers, while raising smaller total amounts, have a much larger percentage edge over Republican incumbents. In Iowa, businesswoman Teresa Greenfield has raised $40.4 million against the $21.8 million raised by first-term incumbent Joni Ernst. In North Carolina, former Army paratrooper Cal Cunningham has raised $43.4 million for his race against first-term incumbent Tom Tillis, who has raised $20.9 million. In Maine, Sarah Gideon, the Democratic leader of the state legislature, has raised $63.6 million for her campaign against three-term incumbent Susan Collins, who has raised less than half that sum, $25.2 million. In Colorado, opinion polls suggest that the contest is a runaway, and political action committees supporting the Democratic candidate, former Governor John Hickenlooper, have pulled out regarding his victory over first-term Republican Senator Cory Gardner as a certainty. Hickenlooper has outraised the incumbent by $36.7 million to $25 million. And in Montana, Governor Steve Bullock has raised $38.1 million for his challenge to first-term incumbent Steve Daines, who has raised $24.5 million. In Alaska, millionaire orthopedic surgeon Al Gross leads incumbent Republican Dan Sullivan $13.9 million to $9.3 million. This is me talking. The reason I've been reading you so many of these facts, and there are lots more in this article, is because I want you to become more aware of the names of the people running down ballot. And I also want to make you aware of the fact that none of these people can call themselves populists if they're raising so much money from big dollar donations. I'm sure the ratio is different depending on the candidate. I'm sure that some of the candidates have raised more small dollar donations, but still, these people are owned, and it's not by us. I'll read you a few more of these names and then I'll skip ahead to the ending. Of the two Democrat seats in the Senate which are at greatest risk on November 3rd, one confirms and one represents an exception to this pattern. In Alabama, incumbent Democrat Doug Jones has outraised his Republican challenger, former football coach Tommy Tuberville, by $24.9 million to $7.5 million, but he is nonetheless considered a distinct underdog in the conservative state. In Michigan, Senator Gary Peters is a slight favorite over Republican challenger John James, a former paratrooper, and he holds only a narrow fundraising lead, $35.7 million to $33.9 million. Only three incumbent Republican senators have raised more money than James, who is being promoted by the Senate Republican leadership and Trump as an African-American face to disguise their reactionary politics. Now here's the point, people. Finally, there is the not insignificant question of what corporate America is buying through this flood of cash into the coffers of the Democratic Senate candidates. The beneficiaries of this corporate largesse are a collection of political reactionaries deeply committed to the defense of American imperialism abroad and big business at home. They differ only at the margins with their right-wing Republican opponents. Of the candidates already listed, four have military intelligence backgrounds as their principal credential. Mark Kelly is a career military pilot and former astronaut. Amy McGrath, a retired Marine fighter pilot. Marie Jennings Hagar flew helicopters for the U.S. military in Afghanistan. Cal Cunningham was an Army Ranger and still teaches new Rangers every year as a reserve officer. These four are the Senate equivalents of the CIA Democrats who played such a prominent role in the Democratic takeover of the House of Representatives in 2018. So big money is voting for the CIA. Other top Senate Democratic challengers include South Carolina's Jamie Harrison, a longtime corporate lobbyist, Teresa Greenfield in Iowa, a millionaire businesswoman, Al Gross in Alaska, a millionaire surgeon whose father was state attorney general, Montana Governor Steve Bullock, and former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper, both failed presidential candidates who ran in the right-wing lane that produced Biden instead, and Barbara Bollier, who was a Republican state senator in Kansas until switching parties in 2018. In the House of Representatives, now firmly controlled by the Democrats, 232 to 197, with five vacancies and a Libertarian, the Democrats are expected to increase their numbers, although by less than the 41 seats they gained in 2018. Republican hopes of retaking control, which would require a net gain of 21 seats, have virtually collapsed, as nearly all the first-term Democrats who won Republican-held seats in 2018 are considered likely victors this year. So, dear viewers and listeners, if you don't want Wall Street to win, we are majorly fucked. All 11 CIA Democrats are favored to win re-election, and they will be joined by at least one military intelligence candidate who won his primary in the heavily Democratic 4th Congressional District in Massachusetts and is a prohibitive favorite, Jake Auchincloss. Several more such candidates are likely to win on November 3rd. Jackie Gordon in the 2nd Congressional District of New York, Dan Feehan in the 1st Congressional District of Minnesota, Sri Preston Kulkarni in the 22nd Congressional District of Texas, and Gina Ortiz-Jones in the 23rd Congressional District of Texas. The result of the election is likely to be a greatly strengthened group of CIA Democrats, including Seth Moulton of Massachusetts, first elected in 2014 and the founder of the Vote Vets Political Action Committee that has been responsible for recruiting and funding many of the military intelligence candidates in the last two elections. Together with the 11 elected in 2018 and another half dozen or so in 2020, this would make a caucus of nearly 20, enough to exercise considerable influence in the new Congress and in a future Biden administration. So to all the dumbass progressives on your Facebook feed and all the dumbass leaders, including politicians and pundits, who are telling us to vote for Biden and push him left, this is what we're trying to push left. This caucus ain't gonna go left. And all of your comfy Democrat friends and all of your comfy Republican friends have no clue what's coming. I'll tell you what's coming. Big money is coming, and they don't give a fuck about you.